This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to the live reading of the Green Valley News for Monday, August 18th. I'm Mark DeGroft. The Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society is keeping busy, seeing plenty of interest as it works to preserve history and share it with residents to ensure that it never fades away. SCVHS member Monica Christensen said that the group's goal is to preserve everything that it can. Two of its big pushes are adding about 5 historical markers per year throughout the community and then getting more space for its speakers series. The nonprofit started in December of 2023, has one historical marker in place at Quail Creek Veterans Municipal Park, noting the former World War II Camp Continental for German prisoners of war. That marker was done in partnership with the town of Suarita, which Christensen said has committed to funding one new historical marker within the town limits annually. The town's next contribution will be a marker for Porter Wilson, who is a longtime Suarita educator, resident, and inventor who was considered instrumental in the development of flag football. Wilson, who was born in May of 1925, died in 2000. Christensen said that SCVHS hopes to have a marker for him placed near the Suarita Aquatic Center by what would have been his 101st birthday next year. Christensen said the markers throughout the town are the signs vendor Territorial Sign Company, run close to $5,000 each, including the concrete footers, and come with a 25-year guarantee against deterioration. SCVHS has a working list of about 120 sites for markers and is taking suggestions for more. SCVHS hopes to get grant funding from places like Freeport McMoRan and Caterpillar, but Christensen said they would also need support from public and local business donations. The historical markers are more than just footnotes around the area, which SCVHS typically defines as within Suarita and Continental School District boundaries. They are also interactive learning platforms for residents, students, and researchers. SCVHS's POW marker has photos and basic information about the camp, but it also includes the link to SCVHS's website with more historical information and German and Spanish translations. Just in the event that someone who was a family member, a descendant, or one of the POWs that was here happened to stumble across the page, Christensen said, of the German translation. He said there is potential for audio recordings down the road. SCVHS is also moving its History All Around Us speaker series from the Joyner Green Valley Library to St. Francis in the Valley Episcopal Church for more space. Christensen said St. Francis will have seating for about 200 people. We have some speakers in the last series where we didn't have a big turnout, but we had a couple, she said. One of the biggest ones was Steve Hoza, who came down to talk about Arizona prisoner of war camps during World War II. Christensen said they had to turn people away from that discussion after room hit its capacity. The free monthly series starts on September 9th with a talk on Arizona's adobe structures by Alex LaPierre. Christensen said the series will also see Hoza return to talk about POW camps on October 14th, giving people another chance to hear about it. Hoza will also give a second presentation in February on World War II airfields in Arizona. He's done a lot of research with that, Christensen said. We also have Paul Tang coming down. His family owned the Continental store. He grew up in Continental, and so he's going to come with a colleague from the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center. And they're going to talk about merchants in Arizona and Chinese history here. The town of Suarita incorporated in 1994 with about 2,000 residents and has grown to nearly 40,000. Green Valley, with another 30,000 part or full-time residents, started rising out of the ground back in 1963. While some might think of Green Valley and Suarita as relatively new area that's ripe with fresh development, or as Christensen said, a crossroad in a school, she said it's far more complex and storied. I think there's a lot of people who can kind of have in mind that they think it didn't exist, but They don't recognize the fact that there were families here, and they had stage stops, and farms grew out, all kinds of amazing things, and the railroad was here, and the mines and the ranches, she said. Christian said much of it was so spread out that people have a hard time picturing the tight-knit community that existed before the local population grew. She said the need to depend on your neighbors came from the area's isolation from Tucson to the north, adding many newcomers might overlook that and the many stories from before recent development. Christensen said part of it is that there was never an organization actively preserving those stories and history. She said SCVHS is trying to capture stories from families predating the town of Suarita and Green Valley before they're lost forever. There's so much history around here, Christensen said. I think the people don't realize it because there's so many people who have moved through the area. Thanks to new legislation that went into effect on July 1st, facilities that provide memory care services to patients with dementia and other neurodegenerative brain disorders must actually train their staff members on how to care for such patients. The Arizona Department of Health Services now requires memory care employees to undergo 8 hours of initial training, followed by 4 additional training hours every year. Managers of such facilities must get an initial 4 hours of training, followed by 4 hours of annual training. A multitude of other rules also went into effect as of last month, said Tori Roberg, who is Director of Government Affairs for the Desert Southwest Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. The policies implemented under House Bill 2764 will go a long way toward addressing issues in assisted living and in nursing homes that offer memory care services, Roberg said, calling them significant for Arizona and facility residents with neurodegenerative disorders. Up until this legislation was passed, Roberg said that facilities sometimes use the phase memory care services to get new patients. It had long been known throughout the industry and government that memory care really didn't mean anything much more than a locked door at assisted living, Roberg said. There was no definition of memory care, so there were no rules. This legislation was not about revamping the rules. It was actually creating something that didn't exist before. Without having definitions and rules, Roberg said the Arizona Department of Health Services had no ability to hold facilities accountable. Work began on crafting the legislation due to a number of factors, Roberg said. The Arizona Republic illustrated issues within the industry, giving Governor Katie Hobbs named it as one of her priorities, she said. There was an Auditor General's report that had come out scathing of all this, but it wasn't just the state of Arizona. There was this groundswell because people were getting hurt, they were neglected and abused throughout the state, and something had to be done, Roberg said. I can tell you, I got hundreds of phone calls and emails, especially when all of this was in the papers, because people were just frustrated that their loved ones weren't getting the care that they deserved or even what they were paying for. And again, this isn't to demonize an entire industry. That's not the case at all. There are many facilities doing this really well throughout the state already, so we know that it can be done. Now memory care services are clearly defined as services that support individuals with dementia and other progressive and neurodegenerative brain disorders, which include specialized environmental features, care planning, directed care services, medication administration services, specialized accommodations, activity programming, and other services that's required by DHS in rule. Roberg said that staff members must be trained by DHS-approved trainers, and facilities have been given 90 days of grace period to get the initial trainings out of the way. They'll be taught how to communicate with people that are living with dementia, the symptoms of dementia, and about the stages of dementia, Roberg said. We've heard of caregivers just not even understanding dementia, yelling at people living with the dementia, and that's really not appropriate care, she said. Staff will also learn about such things as fall prevention and appropriate therapeutic activities. In addition to the mandatory training requirements, facilities with memory care areas must conduct mandatory elopement drills meaning they must hold drills to practice what happens when a patient or a resident wanders away. Families won't even know if their loved one had been gone, or so now they have to contact DHS within 24 hours, but they have to contact the family immediately to let them know that their loved one has eloped. Even if they find that person, they still need to call, let the family know, because the family has that right to know, Groberg said. Now that DHS is in the loop, the state will look for patterns so that technical assistance can be provided if needed. Amy Malkin, executive director of Arroyo Gardens Independent and Assisted Living, said that the rules were definitely needed. She is currently waiting for the state to approve the plan Arroyo Gardens put forth that regarding training policies and procedures. She plans to put her 90 staff members through the initial training in four-hour increments once their plans are approved by the state. She and resident care coordinator Cecilia Nunez are already certified dementia practitioners, she said. It's all the staff that need to go through the training. So the housekeepers, the kitchen staff, everybody's going to need to go through it. And that's a good thing because everybody's interacting with the residents that have dementia, Malkin said. He said Arroyo Gardens hasn't always provided some training to staff to deal with dementia patients, but it wasn't a formalized program. Now all staff members will learn how to deal with agitated and confused residents. They'll learn various techniques such as redirection. The training will not only benefit her residents, but she's also hopeful that it will help with turnover rates, Malkin said. I'm not saying dementia is 100% redirectable, Malkin said about employees being less frustrated with the right tools, but when you have the tools and know how to work with them, the patients are not going to become as agitated, which makes your job an awful lot stressful, less stressful. She said she's heard many stories over the years, and she's hopeful that the training and new rules will mitigate tragedies. There have been times when staff members have disabled door alarms, allowing patients to wander off, she said. That's a big deal to me because there are people that have died from eloping, and I think that if caregivers knew more about dementia, how to redirect people that are trying to wander who are exit-seeking, that might not happen just quite as much, she said. Consultants for Copper World delivered a harsh response to an April memo that blamed water quality degradation on the mining project, that is Copper World project, claiming some of the analysis and conclusions are logically indefensible while others are just flat-out inaccurate. The April memo from County Administrator Jan Lesher quoted a report provided by Jennifer McIntosh, Ph.D., and a professor in the University of Arizona's College of Science and Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences. The report was presented by McIntosh at a January meeting of the Pima County Regional Flood Control District and primarily drew from a 2024 student thesis. The thesis was largely based on information gathered by students since 2015 who are funded by a Pima County contract that had been granted to McIntosh. Pima County has been on the record for years as opposing the mining project owned by Hudbay Minerals. A July 14th letter to Lesher from Javier Del Rio, the senior vice president of Hudbay's U.S. business unit, was included in an August 11th memo from Lesher to the Pima County Board of Supervisors. Del Rio said the review of McIntosh's work identified clear and substantial errors in the analysis presented to the FCD and subsequently to the board. These errors were exacerbated by the failure to include known comparative historical and upstream data points. In fact, when properly analyzed, the data collected nullifies the hypothesis posited and is contrary to the conclusion somehow reached by Dr. McIntosh. Among what Rio de fabled significant errors are her analysis that supplied groundwater standards to surface water samples. This led to an inaccurate conclusion that 14 of 28 samples exceeded water quality standards. Copper World then looked at the remaining 14 samples cited as exceeding standards and found errors or inaccurate connections to the mine's work in that area. One exceedance was cited in an area that has nothing to do with the mine project. Copper World concluded none of the exceedances were legitimate or had a connection with his work. Del Rio said publicly available historic water quality data directly contradicts McIntosh's conclusions of recent water degradation. Del Rio said McIntosh's January presentation left out a key element of the 2024 thesis. He said the thesis points out the increase in sampling and changes in the sampling methodology beginning in 2022 amounts to bias in the data that could be at least partially explained and results pointing to degradation. Hudbay concluded that the use of shoddily evaluated science to cast aspersions against legal activity is inappropriate for the university and the county. In her memo to the Board of Supervisors, Lesher said the county anticipates that McIntosh will respond to the Hudbay critique and that her staff is interested in meeting with ADEQ to better understand how this data is used by the department, particularly for making changes to the Arizona Outstanding Waters designations, as well as impairment findings. An employee of Southern Arizona Community Church quit her job on Wednesday and filed a report with the Pima County Sheriff's Department over concerns about the church's pastor, Stephen Aiken. Aiken has twice made headlines that led tied incidents involving the Suarita Police Department. Last year, he filed a federal lawsuit against the SPD over the handling of domestic violence calls at his house. And last week, his supporters posted a video that they say shows SPD Chief John Nolan using excessive force against a YouTuber who wanted to record Aiken during a deposition connected to his lawsuit. On Wednesday, the former employee, who oversaw audiovisual work at the church, met with the deputy and said that Aiken was acting a little strange. She stated he had been coming to work with a bulletproof vest. He had weapons in his church he carried, and he also invited his parishioners to carry weapons, according to the report. The woman also said Aiken has begun to have side services after the regular church service, during which she shows edited videos tied to his issues with SPD, and that she had assisted in the editing. She stated it was unfortunate that he was editing the videos and not showing the parishioners the full true video, and she believed the individual was somewhat acting like a cult, the report stated. The woman, whom the Green Valley News is not identifying, described what has been going on since the August 7th incident at the police department as strange and weird, and said that Aiken is intimidating. The woman said she was pulled into a meeting on Wednesday with Aiken and other individuals at the church, during which she was told they wanted her to cooperate and be on their side and do as they said, the report stated. She stated that what she believed he was talking about was he had her edit videos and put things in there to make it look one-sided on his end, and she didn't like that, the report stated. She told him that, and at that point in time, she stated she didn't feel comfortable, so she left the business. She asked the deputy to forward her contact information to the SPD so that she could share her information with them. Aiken did not respond to a voicemail message or email seeking comment on Friday. On Thursday, during Aiken's live stream Bible study, he apologized that his Sunday sermon was posted without audio. He then went on to boast about the social media attention his recent battle with SPD had been getting. In the last 2 weeks, she has, well, actually in the last 10 days, between three different YouTube channels, my wife's saga has gone, they call it, viral. She's had over 1 million views, 300,000, almost 400,000 on one channel, and a little over 600,000 on another channel, and even on our church channel, like my channel yesterday. I looked at it. I had 18 views. Today I looked at it and I had almost 3,000 views, Aiken said. He said he's reaching more people without an AV team than when they had one, an apparent reference to the woman's departure. You're going to hear me talk about this on Sunday because I'll have the charts and the graphs and everything for you, he said during that Bible study. But trust me, this is just totally God. I'm dumbfounded. Remember a month and a half ago? I told you how broke the church was. How did we end up with 1 month in the black? I don't know. But we paid all our bills. and that's totally God. Aiken also spoke about six or seven church members leaving the church because of a woman he said misheard him and discussed her claims with others. He said he was asked to explain the situation. "No, I'm not explaining anything to anybody anymore. I've been doing this for 40 years, and I am comfortable with my walk with the Lord. He walks with me, he talks with me, and he tells me that I am his own," Aiken said, quoting a hymn. Stephen and Deborah Aiken filed their federal lawsuit following an incident at their home in April of 2023. The group alleged officers made a false arrest, conducting a false search, and violated their Fourth Amendment rights by illegally refusing requests to leave. The couple alleged they were asleep when the officers showed up at their door to investigate a disturbance call. The caller told the 911 dispatcher she heard an argument and a crashing sound while walking past the couple's home. According to the lawsuit, Stephen recently and repeatedly told officers everybody inside the home was okay while speaking with them through a window next to the front door, but they refused to leave and insisted on speaking with his wife. The lawsuit further claims that even after officers spoke with Deborah on the phone, they refused to leave and insisted that they actually see her. Once they saw her through the window, the lawsuit alleges the officers began insisting that she come outside. According to the lawsuit, Lieutenant Juan Zamora, Sergeants Eric Heath and Oscar Frug, and Officer Zachary Woodrow breached the front door of the home after being on the property 38 minutes, causing the door to strike Deborah Aiken. Aiken, who began the church in 2010, was handcuffed as officers searched the home and found the broken glass, according to the lawsuit. Deborah explained that she had been sick and hadn't felt up to cleaning the dropped glass that night, decided to leave it until morning, according to the lawsuit. During the hour they were on scene, the lawsuit says officers did nothing to try to obtain a search warrant or verify the veracity of the 911 caller's report. According to police officers, officers said they had no probable cause to make an arrest, but described finding broken glass throughout the house in what appeared to be dried blood on the master bedroom door and disheveled furniture. The couple originally filed a notice of claim with the town on October 16th of 2023, noting they were willing to accept $1 and mandatory training for all of the officers on exigent circumstances within 6 months of a signed agreement to resolve the case. According to court records, town attorney Jim Jellison notified the couple's attorney on December 18th of 2023, that they were willing to settle the case under those terms, and the attorneys for both sides hammered out specific training requirements. However, when it came time for the couple to sign off on the agreement, they instead filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court and replaced their attorney, Richard Wintery, with another attorney, Dustin Romney. Romney has since withdrawn from the case, leaving the Aikens without an attorney. On September 12th of 2024, the town of Suarita's attorneys filed a motion to enforce the settlement agreement they believe had been worked out based on Wintery and Jellison's communications and the draft settlement agreement. According to court documents, the town's attorneys emphasized that Wintery never explicitly disputed the existence of a settlement agreement, and Romney believed the agreement had been reached. The Aikens filed a motion arguing there was no binding agreement because there had been no meeting of the minds regarding the specific training requirements. They also asked for permission to seek additional monetary damages. On February 27th, U.S. District Court Judge Rainer Collins ruled that there was no enforceable settlement agreement for just that reason. He also said that Romney asked to meet with Jellison to see whether a binding agreement existed. He didn't agree that one actually did. Collins, citing case law, also ruled the couple can't sue for more than $1. According to police reports, a detective spoke to the Aikens' daughters after the incident, and they told the detective a third party called 911 because one of them had received a phone call from Deborah Aiken, and she could hear Stephen yelling and Deborah crying and pleading in the background. According to the report, the 911 caller told a dispatcher that she had heard a male say, "You will show me respect," and a woman yell, "No, no, no," and "Calm down." Both sisters told police they suspect Stephen Aiken treats their mother poorly and that domestic violence has been an issue in the past that they've witnessed. Stephen Aiken pieced together footage from an officer body camera videos and posted a heavily edited 13-minute video on the social media site Rumble. The title, "Sorry the Police Department Kicked Door in Grandma's Face to Make Sure She's Okay." On August 7th, the Aikens went to the Sorita Police Department to give their deposition in the federal lawsuit with a couple of YouTubers. One of them, James Stringer, who also goes by the name James Freeman, was arrested by Chief Nolan when he refused to allow Nolan to close the door to the conference room where the depositions were to take place. Stringer and his supporters have posted videos of the altercation, with Stringer accusing Nolan of physically and violently attacking him. Stringer claims he was at the police station on Thursday to provide the Aikens extra recording devices that they could use during the depositions. Videos posted on YouTube show Jellison blocking the camera crew from the conference room while Stringer continually taunts and attempts to provoke him. Jellison tries to explain that the Aikens had failed to provide advance notice of their desire to film the depositions as required under court law. Stringer claims in one video that Marana Police Department officers found no evidence to back Nolan's claim that Stringer assaulted him and that they will be asking the Arizona Attorney General's office to file charges against Nolan. Marana Police Captain Tom Brueckenkant and the town of Sorita officials said that Marana will be providing Arizona Attorney General's office witness statements and video evidence to determine if charges should be filed against Stringer and or Nolan. Town Manager Shane Dill said this week that the Arizona Department of Public Safety will launch a secondary investigation to determine if any administrative rules were violated by SPD personnel. And marijuana sales in Arizona slid faster in the second quarter of 2025 than they did in the first quarter, marking the largest year-over-year decrease since voters approved recreational cannabis back in 2020. The decline was led by a sharp drop in recreational cannabis sales in June. Adults purchased just $71 million of marijuana products for the month, almost $14 million less than they did in 2024. And overall, the first half of the year was a disappointing one for Arizona's cannabis industry, with consumers making $43 million less in purchases and sales, coming in at 7.60% lower than in 2024. And that will take care of the reading of the Green Valley News. Mark DeGroat with you. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona.